Hello, and welcome to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Elaine, a longtime sci-fi fantasy fan, reading Frank Herbert's classic science fiction Dune Saga for the very first time. I'm joined by my co-host Alex, who is tackling his first reread. Join our chapter-by-chapter deep dive into the series, as I make wildly incorrect predictions, Alex tries not to give anything away, and together, we learn to walk without rhythm.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Alex, here as always with Elaine.
Hey, guys.
Today, we're going to be diving into chapters 18 and 19 of Dune Messiah, and we'll continue with some more predictions. And then after that, we only have a couple episodes until we wrap up Messiah.
Yeah, our prediction episodes are a lot closer together this time, since we're only going to have, like, 8 or 9 episodes of actual chapter material.
Exactly.
Much shorter book.
Mm-hmm. All right, so without further ado, I'll dive right into the first epigraph. This is an addenda to Orders in Council, the Emperor Paul Muad'Dib. The convoluted wording of legalisms grew up around the necessity to hide from ourselves the violence we intend toward each other. Between depriving a man of 1 hour from his life and depriving him of his life, there exists only a difference of degree. You have done violence to him, consumed his energy. Elaborate euphemisms may conceal your intent to kill, but behind any use of power over another, the ultimate assumption remains. I feed on your energy.
Yeah. I'm not 100% sure what this means in relationship to the chapter, unless it's kind of related to the fact that, oh, maybe the stone burner isn't killing all of these men, but it's severely harming them in a way that you could consider also feeding on their energy. I don't know. I was trying to relate it to the chapter, and I wasn't entirely sure how it fits in.
Yeah, I couldn't really relate it to this chapter. I almost related it more to the next chapter that's related to Corba's trial, which we'll get into. But I guess the direct relation is just legal punishment and comparing jailing people to executing them. Just that, like, if you jail someone for a certain amount of time, you're actually killing, like, a certain amount of their lifespan, sort of, because you're locking them up and preventing them from making any progress in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I sort of got out of it, but I don't really see a way to correlate it to the chapter.
I've had that a couple times where I felt that epigraphs fit better with nearby chapters than the one that it was actually attached to.
Mm-hmm.
But as I think has been common in this book, it does seem that the epigraphs are a little bit more opaque relative to in Dune.
Right. They sort of relate generally to the book overall and not really chapters specifically, I guess.
And they're also just less explicitly informative. And so this is not explaining an event that happened or anything like that, which many of the ones in Dune were.
Mm-hmm.
This is more of a, maybe a window into the way Paul thinks about things.
Yeah, and it's also interesting that Frank Herbert went away from the way he did the first book, where he has Irulan telling most of these, and it's like almost a coherent narrative on its own, off to the side, that's just sort of her perspective. And whereas here, it's just sort of like a mishmash of these different epigraphs that are from different sources, and they just sort of vaguely relate to different things in the plot, or they don't relate at all.
Yeah, I generally find them a lot less effective. There are some books that I've read that make really good use of epigraphs, I think. For example, the Stormlight Archives by Brandon Sanderson tends to have that kind of thing where there is another story being told with the epigraphs that comes into focus later and is illuminating.
Mm-hmm.
And you maybe don't know exactly how they relate at first, and then it all kind of falls into place, and you feel like you really got something out of them, whereas some of these, I could have read this just as easily without them. It didn't really contribute anything to my understanding or knowledge, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that.
So I'm just generally finding them less effective or interesting than they were in Dune.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, our gripes about the epigraphs aside, shall we move into the chapter itself?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay, so we pick up basically right where we left off in the last chapter and episode, where Paul finally gets going out of Othium's house.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul and Bijaz exit Othium's home while the moon shines bright overhead, as Bijaz desperately tries to get Paul to hurry on their way. Paul asks whether he can sense danger, and Bijaz retorts that he knows danger, then cowers while a dark shape emerges from a nearby doorway. However, it just turns out to be Stilgar, and Paul quickly explains who Bijaz is before Stilgar hurries him away, presumably back to the keep. Paul notes how the events of his vision are playing out quickly, perhaps more quickly than he had expected them to from his vision. He orders some of his men to check out the house next to Othium's before darkly thinking to himself that they, perhaps like Othium himself, are sacrifices. Which is certainly true, because Paul knows what's about to happen and still sends them directly into harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike in Othium's house, where minor differences had played out between his vision and reality, now everything is in perfect alignment with what he has seen. Perhaps Bijaz's absence from these events made Paul's premonitions of them more accurate. Like, you wonder if just Bijaz being around maybe shifted some of the events, even if he wasn't directly part of them in Othium's house. Whereas now that he's out of the picture totally, the vision is more or less identical to reality.
Yeah, that would make sense.
A sibilant hissing sound begins to build, softly at first, but soon growing to a roar, accompanied by a dull orange glow. Paul knows exactly what it is, having seen all of this before in his vision, but there is panic in the voices of his men as they realize what it signifies, a stone burner nearby. Up until this point, all we'd heard about stone burners is that they are closely related to atomics, and that they were responsible for burning out the eyes of Farrakh's son. Paul's men scream, but Paul feels oddly at peace seeing these events play out as he expects them to. So I'm glad Paul at least is feeling relaxed about this whole ordeal. As his men panic about being blinded or killed. This did make me think back to the chapter with Farrakh and his son and Cytel, because there was a weird note about how, you know, Farrakh's son was blinded by a stone burner, and it was on some specific planet, and Cytel thought it was weird because the face dancers didn't have any knowledge of there being a stone burner on that planet. And since the stone burner is part of this Fremen conspiracy, it made me wonder whether you're supposed to read into that, that Farrakh's son's eyes actually got burned out, like, related to this stone burner, like, getting it here, or testing it out or something.
Interesting.
I don't know, because they didn't really go back to it. Like, there was never any explanation of why that detail was mentioned or why Cytel thought it was weird. Like, they never go back to it. So it just made me think of, like, oh, maybe you're supposed to read into it that Farrakh's son was injured not on that planet. Because there was also, like, why would he come back to Arrakis? Because he allegedly had kids on that planet or something. So maybe that was just the story. I mean, there's not really evidence for or against it, but it just made me think back to that kind of weird detail that never really got resolved.
Yeah, it's kind of like one of those interesting conspiracy theories that you can, like, think about.
It could be a headcanon, but it probably won't ever be explicitly confirmed. But
yeah, exactly.
Just something I thought about when I was reading this.
Interesting, though. But this whole chapter, in a way, is a callback to that other chapter, just because it so closely relates with the stone burner and the blindness and such.
Yeah, I mean, it was clear foreshadowing, or maybe not even foreshadowing might not be the right word, but just, I guess, sort of a Chekhov's gun sort of thing, where they mention this weapon that blinds people, and so, of course, it's going to be relevant in the plot later.
Yeah, like, there has to be a payoff.
Why give that exposition unless it was relevant
right.
for later in the book? Okay, so despite knowing that it will do no good, Paul does what was expected of him, so he basically just play acts here and just covers his face and dives behind a curb, but for no real reason, because it won't do anything. It's completely ineffective, because Paul is standing too close to the stone burner for his little dive routine to have any protective effect on him.
Right, I think the other thing that's mentioned in the chapter is that, like, once the, like, burst from the stone burner happens, like, the damage is already done. So anything you do to, like, cover yourself up doesn't really make a difference.
Yeah, and, like, putting your hand across your face isn't going to stop radiation. You know, that's not how radiation works.
Yeah, I guess it's just that human instinct to, like, do anything you can to protect yourself, even if you know it's futile deep down. It's just you have to try to do something to stop whatever could happen to you.
Yeah, and Paul knows it's not going to do anything, but he's seen himself do it in the vision, so he's just following what he's seen, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's pointless. It seems that the stone burner was either below Othium's home or the one next to it, with Othium's home now nothing but a towering pillar of flames. Paul's men scramble to flee, but for them, like for Paul himself, it is too late to escape their fate. While certainly less devastating than being within the blast radius of a true nuclear weapon, every man here will now be blind. The radiation of a stone burner apparently affects primarily just the eyes. Or at least there's no mention of any long-term cancer effects or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Which maybe there would be something like that, but maybe like spice in your diet offsets that or something. Or
stone burners are new enough of a phenomenon that they don't really know the long-term consequences. Because they were never mentioned before, which, I mean, may or may not mean anything.
Yeah, all we do know is there is radiation that can set in that may or may not have a major effect, but it seems like there isn't one since there isn't anything else mentioned about that. But at least we do know that the eye tissue is what's damaged the most.
Yeah. Paul hears a few of his men anxiously bickering as they wait to see what else will happen. One bitterly comments that the Tsilaxu will have many new customers for their metal eyes. As it turns out, while blindness-inducing radiation is certainly an effective way to take down enemy troops, it seems that this is more of a side effect than the true purpose of the device, which seems to be basically the sort of laser a supervillain would use to cut into the core of the Earth in an old Bond film or something. Like, it made, honestly, what it made me think of was Austin Powers, where it's like a drill into the center of the Earth rather than a laser, but same idea.
Same, yeah. It seems like a ridiculous concept, but yeah.
Like, it seems like the point is to drill down into the Earth to potentially explode the planet or something, based on what we learn in the next chapter when Korba is on trial. And I'm just like, this seems like a very, I don't know. I mean, I guess it would be a sort of last stand gambit of if someone is invading your planet, you threaten to just blow it up. But that also seems like a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess as an offensive weapon, you could threaten the inhabitants of a planet with blowing it up if they don't cave to your demands, but yeah, I don't know. But it does seem like in this circumstance, they weren't trying to cut down into the planet and explode it, and were just trying to use the radiation effects of it for some reason. I guess specifically to target Paul.
Right.
And I guess the plan was that this would also have targeted Chaney and somehow led to her death.
Yeah, well, remember, they originally wanted Chaney to go with Paul to be there.
Exactly. So I wonder why that is. So as we get into a little bit later in the chapter, the Fremen expectation for the blind is that they will just, like, willingly commit suicide in the desert, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if, because Chaney is, like, a full-blooded Fremen, they expected, if she was blinded, that she would do that.
Well, maybe not only that, but there's a couple things at play here, right? Because I guess plan A was get Paul and Chaney there and kill them both with a stone burner, right? You blow up the house, everyone inside, and then you kill them. You kill that family line, and then I guess the only person left to be in charge would be Irulan, right?
But I don't think they wanted to kill Paul. It sounded like they wanted to kill Chaney so that the Tsilaxu could bargain with him.
I guess, but they blew up the house that Paul was in.
I know, and but Bijaz got them out first.
That's true.
And if he's part of their plan, which it seems likely that he is, right? He's their catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
Then why would he have done that? It didn't seem like the idea was to kill Paul. It sounded like their plan was that they wanted to kill Chaney.
Well, maybe not necessarily kill Chaney, but like you were saying about the blindness, maybe the plan was to blind Paul and Chaney, so then the Fremen look down on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sort of get discredited, right? The Fremen thing to do would be to kill yourself in the desert at that point, right? So how could you continue to rule when you're in that state? I think what would be expected of them from the Fremen perspective is to walk out into the desert.
Yeah, it's just there was something specific about them wanting to make sure that Chaney was killed in such a way that Paul would blame himself.
For bringing her along?
Yeah. So in the chapter where Saitel is impersonating Leekna, in his thoughts he says, or I guess she at that point, says, of Paul, he must lose his Fremen concubine in circumstances where no other shared the blame. The failure must belong only to the omnipotent Muad'Dib. He had to be led into an ultimate realization of his failure, and thence to acceptance of the Tsilaxu alternative. So they specifically wanted to kill Chaney, and Paul would feel the blame for it, so that somehow that would force him to accept some Tsilaxu alternative. Perhaps they offer to Gola eyes her because he's so distraught over her death.
Yeah.
Or something like that. I don't know what else they could offer him. Although I don't really know how helpful that would be since they can't restore her memories or anything like that. But it still might be enough maybe they are hoping to bargain with him for that.
But nobody said that Golas can't reproduce, so maybe the hope is he gets a new Chaney that has the same DNA, and then...
he could at least have her babies, or yeah. babies with her or something. I don't know, maybe. But so the point is that it doesn't seem like this plot was meant to kill Paul. It was meant to kill Chaney, but then she didn't go, but Cytale for some reason still thought it was worth it. Perhaps just to injure him, to maybe throw him off or make him easier to manipulate or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I guess I don't know how this plan was meant to kill Chaney, I guess was my point, if the radiation doesn't actually kill people.
But presumably the people who are going to blow up Paul and Chaney, or maybe not kill them, but you know, release the stone burner, would probably have been praised of the fact that Chaney wasn't going there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that their calculus didn't change with it just being Paul going there. They were still going to bomb the house. And maybe that was also because they wanted to get rid of Othium as well.
Yeah, it seems likely that... well, it's interesting because I didn't get the impression that Othium had betrayed Paul at all. It seemed like they were actually trying to warn him and had just been manipulated by the conspirators.
Right, but that's my point, that the conspirators would want to eliminate Othium for betraying them.
Yeah, or they just don't care enough to bother preserving his life, and his house is next door, so he's toast. But at any rate, I guess what I was getting to is I wonder if the way that Chaney was going to be killed was that she would be blinded and feel the obligation to go into exile in the desert and die,
yeah.
and Paul would be unable to stop her and thus feel responsible, or if they just... we're hoping that in the confusion of everyone being blinded, they'd be able to have a more conventional assassin hit Chaney.
Yeah, that's a possibility as well.
But yeah, at any rate, unclear exactly what the original plan was. Anyway, Paul's men are restless, thinking that the machine is dying down, but he warns them to stay put until Stilgar sends help, confirming that Stilgar, and therefore probably Bijaz, had not been caught in the weapons radius. They'd gotten out early enough that they were outside of its area of effect.
Mm-hmm.
Paul hears a man who was even closer to the weapon than he was cry out that he had lost his sight. For his part, Paul can still see down the street, but everything is misty from the damage to his eyes. At this point, I thought that this was going to be the extent of the damage to his vision and that he would just be kind of partially blinded, but as we learn shortly, that's not the case. From what he can still see, nothing remains of either house but a dull red glow. Paul stands up as he feels the stone burner die beneath the ground. He inhales the sulfurous air and is sweating far too much for his steel suit to handle. As he watches his men stand around him, the remnants of his vision fade and he becomes fully blind. However, he is able to somehow use his perfect memories of the future to see, basically matching up what he has previously seen of events with the present, and being able to act as though his sight is just as it had always been. So he can, like, recall his future memories to know where people are standing and what they're doing, basically. His men are not so fortunate, not having any significant prescience that we know of. And he hears their distress as they discover their own blindness. He tells them that he is Muad'Dib and commands that they hold their positions as they wait for help. One man desperately asks whether anyone can still see to confirm that it is, in fact, the Emperor speaking. Paul proclaims that he is truly Muad'Dib, and that he too has had his sight stolen from him, but is yet able to see them standing before him, though he doesn't really explain.
Mm-hmm.
Which must be confusing.
Although, I think they all kind of know that he has visions, right? So
he has powers, yeah.
They could probably put two and two together.
Well, even I guess I don't know the extent of what they know about his powers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but even if they don't...
they still think he's basically a god, so I'm sure it's not exactly that surprising to them.
They'd be able to just assume, oh, he has some sort of power that's letting him see us, because he's all magical and such.
Paul hears Stilgar bringing reinforcements by Thopter, and then hears Stilgar disembarking, matching the footsteps that he hears up with his future vision of Stilgar's arrival. He waves him over and relives the moment as Stilgar's relief that his friend and messiah has survived turns to horror as he sees the ruins of Paul's eyes. So, it clearly doesn't just mess up the nerve tissue or something so that you can't see. It clearly has some obvious, visible, clear effect on the eyes as well.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, I'm, like, very squeamish about eyes. Like, I'm generally not super squeamish about stuff, but Like, I can't even put eye drops in, as you well know. Yeah. Like, so this just is so ugh to me. Just the idea that you'd have this radiation that just, like, crumbles your eyes to dust, basically. Or whatever exactly it does.
Certainly horrifying.
Yeah. That
even for someone terrible. Who is fine with touching their eyes.
Another of the reinforcements asks about the stone burner, and Paul turns to explain to him that it is no longer running, so it's, I guess, relatively safe now. I guess there's not much in the way of lingering radiation.
Mm-hmm. It's just kind of a burst, and then it's done.
Mm-hmm. Paul commands that the men closest to the weapon be rescued, and Stilgar disbelievingly asks whether he can still see. Paul reaches out to touch the tears on Stilgar's cheeks. Typical Fremen gesture.
Yep. Touching each other's faces.
Yes, when they're crying. And Paul tells him that Stilgar need give no moisture to one who is not dead. Paul explains, or at least tries to explain to Stilgar, that he may be blinded, but he is living in an apocalyptic dream, already have experienced what will come to pass.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he finds some bitter humor in the fact that he might find it boring to have to relive events so exactly. Stilgar believes that they will need to hide Paul's condition due to the Fremen traditions regarding the blind. As we discussed previously, and as we might recall from the chapter about Farrakh and his son, the Fremen are particularly harsh in their treatment of those who lose their sight, sending them out into the desert to die alone of exposure and thirst, I guess.
And worms.
Yeah, and worms, that's true. And it's honestly even harsher, I feel like, than people who are severely wounded, where at least the thinking there is still horrible, but of a more practical nature of, like, well, you're worth more to us now for your water than it would be to treat you. In this case, they're not even, like, using them for their water. It's not even that calculus. It's like, you're so worthless, we're just going to let you die in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying it would be better if they just killed them and took their water, but it's just, there's not even a practicality aspect of your water is worth more to us than the care we would have to give you. They're just like, you're so worthless, just go die in the desert. I don't know, it's pretty terrible.
Yeah, I mean, you can chalk it up with virgin sacrifices, right?
Oh, that's fair. And, like, it's also, like, sure, maybe you're probably not going to be, like, a Fremen warrior if you've been blinded, but it's not like you can't, like, work with your hands still, like,
mm-hmm.
make stuff.
Yeah, I guess they just see it as a disability that's too much of a liability to deal with.
Oh, pretty harsh.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably Stilgar's thinking here is that Paul might lose support among the Fremen naives if he is blinded but does not willingly follow this same path.
Mm-hmm.
Although, in a world where you can get mechanical eyes, I feel like that should maybe be the first thought.
Yeah, but as we know, the Fremen are really
superstitious,
and they don't really care for such technologies.
Well, when the alternative is sending someone to, like, die in the desert, I feel like you should maybe overcome your superstitions.
Well, traditions are very difficult to overcome.
Sure. At any rate, Paul disagrees with Stilgar, saying that he will not hide his condition from anyone. He states that, first of all, they follow Atreides' law now, and even so, the Fremen law of abandoning the blind in the desert does not apply to him, because he's not truly blind. So, definitely playing some word games here, I guess,
mm-hmm.
with the definition of blind, but, I mean, he's also not wrong.
Right.
Even if you assume that you need to follow the Fremen laws and that they're not horrible, he can still see as effectively as anyone with eyes, so he is not technically blind.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, one of the wounded men is led past Paul, and he very fortunately remembers that while he might have magic abilities to allow him to see, his men don't have this advantage. So he steps in and forbids that any of them be sent to the desert, which I was a little concerned that he wouldn't think about. And he further orders that they all be fitted with Tleilaxu eyes at his expense, and Stilgar agrees. So at least Paul is not going to allow the Fremen traditions to dictate the fates of the men who have sacrificed their sight for him.
Right.
Which I appreciated. Yep. I give Paul a lot of shit, but this was a good move. Although, to be fair, since he knew it was coming and he sent them into danger with that foreknowledge, it is literally the least he can do.
Yeah, fair enough.
They wouldn't be in that position if he hadn't ordered them into danger.
Mm-hmm. Although, I guess he needed to do that to maintain the vision.
Very comforting to the men, I'm sure. Guys, guys, relax. I know you're all blind now, but I promise you it was very important. But I can't tell you why. Paul then walks down the street towards the command thopter that has landed, calling out orders and speaking with the men by name and so on, which wholly freaks out everyone as they see that his ruined eyes seem to have had no effect on his vision. So I'm sure you would imagine someone with... I mean, I guess I don't really know what his eyes looked like, but the horror that everyone seems to express upon seeing them, mm-hmm. especially someone like Stilgar, who doesn't seem easily shaken, implies that it's a pretty horrific-looking injury.
Yeah, and based on the description we get from the beginning of the next chapter, it sounds like he basically just has no eyes. Like, he just has empty eye sockets.
Yeah, there's a reference to them, like, scraping out all the damaged tissue.
Yeah.
Which, as I said, squeamish about eyes, I do not like that.
So, his eyes look like shit. That's basically all we need to know right now.
Yeah, so the juxtaposition between this guy who is walking down the street with, like, burning craters where his eyes used to be, or just, like, red, half-melted eyes, or whatever, like, awful thing has happened to them, but is acting like he can see totally fine, would definitely be a hard thing to make sense of, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Even if he is Wadib. Once arriving at the thopter, he barks some more orders into a communicator that he snatches out of the hands of a very startled attendant, and then summons a weapons specialist, an officer young enough that life in the siege is little more than a distant dream. So, he must be like 15, which is quite young to be an officer. Or a military person, generally. Paul tells the man that a stone burner was used, and the man acknowledges that this means that atomic fuel must have been used here. Paul sees the man's mind racing with the implications, especially regarding the great houses. The use of this forbidden weapon will unite them above their petty squabbles and bickering, fearing the power of this threat more than any of their individual goals. Retribution will be brutal and as a united front whenever the perpetrator is discovered. So, Paul orders the man to discover how the device was manufactured, as traces will certainly have been left. So this seems to imply that it was created here or built here on Arrakis.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps that is how Farrakh's son might have lost his vision in my headcanon, I guess. Mm-hmm. In putting it together here on Arrakis, maybe. Paul wishes the man to discover where the stone burner was actually created, and the man nods and hurries off. Paul orders someone to call Chaney and let her know that he is alive and will be with her soon. We end yet again on an ominous note as Paul smells the fear and the sweat of the man all around him, which is an interesting talent.
Sweat sense.
So that's the chapter.
Yeah, so what did you think about this chapter?
I mean, it's pretty short generally. Not a ton happens. It's just one big event that happens that's pretty monumental,
mm-hmm.
in that Paul is physically blinded, and we learn that he is somehow able to align his visions with reality so well that it doesn't really matter that he can't see. We can get into this more maybe in our, like, wrap-up of the book, but I do find it a little contradictory that we go from Paul being, like, finding it very difficult to see the future and having to, like, take massive spice doses to see anything. And the Dune Tarot is clouding stuff. But now that he's blind, he can just, like, perfectly match up his visions with reality. It seems a little plot contrivancy to me, but whatever.
Well, at the same time, remember we had Paul sort of lock onto that one vision about what's going to happen with, like, going out into the desert with Chaney and, like, she's going to die and all that, and that being, like, that single unifying vision that he was focusing on, which I think at this point he's continuing to focus on that, and that's really what's helping him through this and helping him see, because if he maintains that one vision of this is what's going to happen, I need to just fall in step with everything I need to do to make sure this vision happens, then he can still see the events of that vision and therefore can still sort of see around him what's happening related to it.
Yeah, I guess. I just don't know when he had such clarity that he's able to recall it now, because it seems like he hasn't had clarity like that in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just not sure when he acquired this extremely clear vision of the future.
Right, but there's also that whole, like, if you lose a sense, like, your other senses get stronger thing, right? So maybe that's sort of being leaned on here.
I don't think that happens instantaneously. I believe that is an adaptation over time.
Sure, but Frank Herbert isn't a scientist, so...
I don't think even, like, an average layperson thinks that if you got blinded, your hearing would suddenly be Daredevil levels.
No, I don't think so.
Anyway. It just fits in with the general, I guess, lack of clarity that we've really had throughout these books about Paul's abilities and the extent of them. Mm-hmm. It seems to vary how accurate his visions are and how much he can see and things like that, depending on what's needed for driving the plot forward from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess with this, he had the tarot, it was blinding him, it was causing issues with him being able to see, and then he found a way to get to this vision, which sort of let him break through that to an extent to focus on this one vision, and now he's just going to continue focusing on that so he can maintain that vision because he's lost his physical vision. That's sort of my interpretation of what's going on.
Yeah. When we get to the next chapter, I'm going to bring something up that I'm not sure how it fits into that thought.
Okay.
And it's one of my previous questions I've had about Paul's visions and their accuracy. All right, so shall we move into the next chapter?
Well, before that, so generally, what were your overall impressions of this chapter? I mean, it was kind of different from the other chapters we've seen, right?
I mean, yeah, it was more action-oriented, I guess. Mm-hmm. Less confusing discussions with, I don't know, various parties who are always talking around what they actually mean. This was very much just something happened and what's the aftermath of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was, honestly, for me, when I first read this, when I was doing my first read-through, it sort of shocked me that Frank Herbert took this step with Paul and blinded him. I thought that was really surprising. And also, I thought this whole thing with him still being able to see, which I know there's, like, questions around that, but him still being able to see is just really cool that, like, he can still see even though he's blind, and I just thought that was fascinating.
Oh, I think it's a really interesting mechanic, and it makes sense. It's just, I find it a very sudden, sharp transition to his previous lack of clarity. I think if there weren't questions about that, I would find this a completely reasonable explanation, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, yeah, if you can see what's already happened, you're just reliving events, and you have, like, perfect mentat clarity memory, where you can actually just pull up your future memories and run them alongside real time, like, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I find it a little weird that he can suddenly do this when, you know, not long ago, he was having difficulty seeing anything. And there has been no apparent change to the Dune Tarot. Like, they haven't taken any steps to make people stop using it or anything like that. I don't think we're going to get an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, shall we move on to the next chapter?
Sure.
You want to epigraph us?
Always a good place to start. So this is The Moon Falls Down, Songs of Muad'Dib. He has gone from Aaliyah, the womb of heaven. Holy, holy, holy. Fire sand leagues confront our Lord. He can see, without eyes. A demon upon him. Holy, holy, holy. Equation. He solved for martyrdom. I can tell you hate this.
I do hate this.
I also sort of hate this.
I mean, the first thing is I don't like them describing him as leaving Aaliyah, who they describe as the womb of heaven. Like, that's just a weird juxtaposition of, like, his sister giving birth to him, and I don't like that at all.
Yeah, and I mean, she has Jessica's memories, but still fucking weird.
Yeah, that's weird. The description of seeing without eyes is a demon upon him was kind of interesting. I don't know if that's meant to imply that his future visions are kind of a curse as well as a blessing, or exactly. Or if the demon upon him was the stone burner taking his sight. I thought that was a little bit unclear. And then the thing at the end about equations is just, like, it just sounds awkward and weird in, like, a hymn sort of context, right?
I didn't like
that. I hated that.
The thing that bothers me the most about this epigraph is if we remember the last one, which was sort of like a Law and Order epigraph that relates more closely to, like, the Korba trial that happens in this chapter. This one, talking about Paul being blinded, relates more to the last chapter. So honestly, if you flipped them, I think it would make a lot more sense. I know you probably wouldn't want to spoil the whole Paul blindness thing.
I think that's probably it.
Yeah, and that's probably why, but maybe slightly adjust that and don't make it so explicit and put it in front of the other chapter and then put the Law and Order one in front of this one that deals with Law and Order. It just doesn't really make any sense that they're flipped like that.
Yeah, I would agree with that, actually. I hadn't really considered that before, but yeah, if you made it slightly less explicit and didn't say, like, he is blinded and just said something about some trial that he's going through or or darkness more vaguely or there's something.
Right.
And then, yeah, that would make sense. I agree with that take. But either way, I didn't love this because it just had, like, some weird bits that were either just explicitly uncomfortable or just sounded off in the context of, like, a poem or a hymn or a song.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's dive into the chapter itself.
Let's do it.
The keep is unusually quiet after a week of flurried activity post-Stoneburner attack. The people gossip about Paul's new abilities, and rumors of Corba the Panegyrist being brought as a prisoner before the Fremen Naibes, which will ultimately be the focus of this chapter. Chaney awakens in the silence and sees Paul beside her, and we learn that medical intervention has removed all of the ruined flesh from the stone burner, leaving him with empty eye sockets, as we discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Despite his order to Stilgar regarding his blinded men, he himself refuses to use Tlaloxu eyes because he's suspicious of them. Due to her crazy pregnancy, Chaney begins eating ravenously, a plate of food conveniently at her bedside. Paul tells her that there was no way to spare her this, which seems to be obviously a lie. There was clearly a way to spare her from this. Don't get her pregnant. Certainly, he seems to feel as if he had no other choice but to let this happen to her, but there most certainly were other ways to proceed, I think. Although, in his perspective, those could have been worse outcomes.
Yeah, in order to have the vision that's the optimal vision from his perspective, things needed to go this way.
Yeah. It's just since we don't really have a picture of the alternative, it is hard to judge that. Paul muses about belief and faith, and Chaney feels that she cannot understand his odd words anymore. She notes that he appears gaunt and haunted, and he tries to comfort her, saying that only a few things remain to be done at the keep, and they will go to the desert soon. Given Aaliyah's concerns about Chaney giving birth in the siege, this is not very comforting to me as the reader. I don't think we should go to the desert soon, Paul. I think you should stay in the keep. I certainly think that Chaney shouldn't go to the desert, and certainly should not be giving birth there. Chaney shudders at the way Paul states this with a sort of inevitability, and he tells her to forget mystery and accept love, which just seems like him trying to distract her from questions that he will refuse to answer. However, she doesn't doubt his love for her. He promises her that their child will rule an empire that is nothing in comparison to his own, full of art and beauty. She protests that she doesn't want to think about the future, she wants to live in the now, feeling that they do not have much time, perhaps having some sort of subconscious premonition of her likely impending demise. Paul says that they have eternity, and she reminds him that she doesn't have his powers and she only has the present. And he cryptically and unhelpfully replies that now is eternity. Honestly, he is so annoying in this conversation, where he just keeps talking about, like, now is forever. We have all the time in the world. And she's like, no, we don't.
Well, I think he's just trying to hang on to what he has here and make the moments he has with Chaney last as long as they can.
Yeah, but, like, maybe try to actually comfort the hyper-pregnant woman whose babies are killing her. And we'll get to that point in just a moment. The babies, rather than the singular baby. Paul puts a hand against her stomach, and they can both feel the stirring. Paul tells the little ruler of the universe, as he says, to wait its turn, because it's his time now. This confuses Chaney, because as it turns out, she's not just having one baby, like I and apparently Paul had been assuming. She's instead having twins, and feels as if Paul should know about this, even if nobody has explicitly told him, because he should have seen it. She thinks about how he knows everything about her, and wonders why the topic has never come up between them. But then she proceeds not to bring it up, which I find highly odd.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, it's weird that, first of all, that she just has never mentioned it, or that the doctors have never mentioned it to Paul. Just the fact that it has never once come up in conversation between them that she's having twins. I just feel like that's something that a couple would probably discuss when one of them found out about it.
So, couple things, though. First point, when did Paul lock in this vision that he's on now? Was it before she would have had twins, or was it after, like, it would have been definite that she was having twins?
I mean, if he knows she's having a baby.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is maybe when he originally locked in this vision, the vision was that there would be one baby. So that's the vision he's locked into and assuming will be the case. But maybe reality has sort of already veered slightly off of that vision, but he's still, like, following things as if that vision will be the one that comes true, where there's one baby.
I mean, it seems fairly likely that a large part of the reason her pregnancy is so insane that she's got not just a crazy pregnancy, but two babies in there that are, like, rapidly killing her. So it seems like that would have a significant impact on, like, the timeline of things.
Yeah, it would. But we also don't know how far ahead Paul is looking with this vision. I mean, he could just have this vision locked in up to the point that Chaney gives birth and then the vision ends, right? There's no saying that the vision he's locked into goes until the end of the existence of the universe, right?
I mean, it must go beyond Chaney's pregnancy, though, because he knows of the ultimate outcome and seems to think that this is best for the universe writ large. So it's not just about Chaney.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
I don't know. Okay, my first point was just that it's weird that they never discussed this. Mm-hmm. Aside from his visions, I just find it really weird that it has never once come up in conversation that there will be two babies.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
That is strange, no matter, visions aside. The other thing is that, what you were getting at, is that I find it very strange that he is able to have this, like, perfect vision of reality that he is able to line up so well that he's able to use it to, like, fake seeing.
Mm-hmm.
But it completely misses the existence of a whole fucking person.
Right.
That he doesn't seem to know exists.
Right. So that was just one theory, right? The other potential thing here, too, is he doesn't necessarily acknowledge that he doesn't know there's two babies, right? He's focusing on the little rule of the universe. Maybe he knows there's two babies in there, but he's only focusing on one of them.
I don't know. I guess I just trust Chaney's interpretation that it seems like he doesn't know about it. Like, her reaction is like, doesn't he know there's twins? And she's not stupid, so I guess I just assumed that her perspective there was accurate, mm-hmm. or that her read of the situation was accurate.
Yeah, I think you could read into a situation where Paul knows there's two babies, but he's focusing on one.
It just seems kind of weird, though. Like, he's just ignoring one of them, the existence of one whole child.
Maybe it's not that one's less important, but the other one's more important.
To what? I don't know. I guess I was just basing this based on the fact that, from Chaney's perspective, it seems as if he thinks there's only one baby.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the thing what he's saying here is, like, it, like, the baby or babies or whatever kick, and he's like, wait your turn. That doesn't really seem like it's addressed to one specific baby.
Yeah. I don't know. My second theory makes sense if you consider stuff that I won't talk about today.
Okay. We can come back to this at the end of the book, maybe. Oh, my other point is simply just that if he's wrong about this, what else is he wrong about? What else is he not seeing?
Mm-hmm.
If in fact he is not actually seeing a whole ass baby, what else is he missing? What else is he wrong about? Is his vision as accurate as he thinks it is? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've argued before that it's not, and he routinely misses very important things like the death of his firstborn,
right,
and the attempt on Jessica's life from Gurney.
Mm-hmm. And things like Bijaz not even showing up in his vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it's not like he has a crystal clear. So if Bijaz was in the room, he wouldn't be able to see him. So this mm-hmm. wouldn't work properly in all circumstances, right?
Right.
His, like, vision thing? I don't know. I think this is meant to perhaps cast some doubt on things playing out exactly as Paul expected, or at least that was my interpretation of why this little aside about the twins happens.
Mm-hmm.
In the, like, a meta-narrative perspective. So we'll see if it means anything. Maybe it doesn't, and Paul's vision is perfectly accurate, and this is the only thing that he misses, but that just seems unlikely to me. Okay, so the fact that Chaney does not mention this whole twin thing aside, she verbally, although to me fairly unconvincingly, says that she agrees that now is forever. Because she doesn't really seem like that's how she feels, but she seems like she's just kind of yesing Paul. Like, okay, honey, now is eternity. And she closes her eyes so as not to have to look at the horror of his blank eye sockets, wishing only to feel his caresses, which are her comfort in the weirdness and uncertainty that he has brought into their lives recently. When they eventually get up to dress, she muses about how she wishes the people could feel the love that she feels from Paul, which seems kind of hopelessly naive from an apparently smart woman. Maybe chalk it up to crazy magic pregnancy, but, like, she has to know that, like, Paul's rulership has not been of net benefit for a huge proportion of the galaxy, right?
Right.
Like, 63 billion people are dead or something like that.
I mean, maybe
that doesn't feel very loving to me.
Yeah, I guess. Maybe some cognitive dissonance there as well.
Yeah. Paul argues that people prefer order over love. Too much freedom brings chaos, and there isn't any way to make despotism lovable. So he's taking a very much rather be feared than loved Machiavelli sort of perspective here. Cheney, with what again feels like bizarre naivete from someone described as very intelligent, tries to argue that Paul isn't a despot because his laws are just. And again, Paul disagrees, harshly philosophizing on the nature and morality of laws and justice. Cheney can argue with his logic, but she also feels that he's just in a mood, where he takes Fremen's self-flagellation to an extreme. She crosses to stand next to him, looking out the window at the shield wall. I will say, in this circumstance, I think Paul has a better read on the reality than Cheney does here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know if I agree with Paul's take that freedom brings only chaos. I do think that he is at least accurately acknowledging that he is, in fact, a despot.
Yes.
Feeling Cheney next to him, Paul momentarily relaxes his hold of the future that he is using for sight, allowing himself to just experience standing there with her next to him. Without sight, all he can do is listen, hearing Cheney breathe beside him. He thinks about all the futures that he had once seen, which ultimately did not come to pass. And it seems as if he must actively work to keep these from his mind so that they do not overwhelm his vision of the present. Or his memories of the future that he is using as his vision of the present. He describes how his prescience gives him a sort of immortality, seeing and experiencing countless possible futures, but the penalty is that eventually all time just becomes one. His future vision as regular vision returns, and he feels himself locking into the specific pathway of events that his future has shown him. He is at this point just acting out what he has already seen. Which sounds incredibly frustrating and boring, I have to say.
Yeah, right?
You're just, like, replaying events. And it also really undermines your perception of free will. Because, I mean, on the one hand, presumably... Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of like a closed loop of, like, presumably the actions that he's taking, that he's seen himself take and is now reliving, are based on what he would do under the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But also, he can't escape from the fact that he's already seen them, so it's kind of just... When were those decisions made, and by who?
Yeah, so I guess my takeaway is that I understand the pain of parents who have to watch the same Disney movie for the 100th time with their kids.
I feel like this is perhaps more akin to watching a horror movie on loops rather than a Disney film. Maybe just watching the very beginning of a Disney film where, like, the mom dies over and over
again. Potato, potato. But, yeah, he's basically a slave to his vision, right?
Yeah. At least his one particular vision that he feels he has to act out. Cheney reminds him that he should be getting going for the council meeting, but he reassures her that Aaliyah will take her place and that she knows what to do. We then switch to Aaliyah's perspective. For her part, she watches from her room while Korba is brought into the yard below by the guards. She tries and fails to reconcile the Korba that she knows from the early days in the siege, a fierce Fremen commander, with the foppish man in silks who stands there now. She feels similarly about some of the other Fremen naives gathered below, even as they try to exhort Korba to protest his innocence. She feels that they have all become spoiled hedonists, and notes how they nervously look at the council chamber door, afraid of Paul's new powers of blind sight, of this man who should be left to the desert, but has instead somehow managed to see without eyes. She turns to go downstairs, but as she does, she notes a letter from Jessica on her table. Apparently there has been some push to make Caladan a stop on the pilgrimage due to its significance as Paul's birthplace, but Jessica is absolutely not having that, having no desire to have her home swamped with pilgrims, or as she puts it, a rabble invasion. Aaliyah muses about how the use of this physical letter, written in the Atreides battle language, is more secure than any other more sophisticated means of communication. We learn that thinking of Jessica often unsettles Aaliyah, as her awakening while Jessica was still pregnant with her seems to have exacerbated her experiences of her mother's memories. Unsettlingly, this includes her sometimes thinking of Paul as her own son and of her late father as her lover, which I think we'd alluded to before, but get unfortunate confirmation of here.
Yeah, and it makes sense, but still, it's as unnerving as it was before.
Yeah. Ugh. Aaliyah reflects more on the letter, which expresses warnings of the conflict between religion and government and how they are fundamentally opposed to one another. You can't govern without laws, but imposing laws regarding practice of religion removes the spontaneity which drives religion, and eventually nothing will be left but the laws. So, I mean, it makes sense. If you impose a religion on people, a lot of people are not going to be true proponents of that religion, true believers.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of just yesing because if they don't, they'll be killed.
Yeah, just keeping up appearances.
And I think Paul even alluded to that when he was having his complainy thoughts about the bureaucrats in the Kizarat who are not really true believers but kind of just pay lip service because they have to.
Yeah.
Aaliyah gets downstairs and sets off with her guards. She notes that they, like many Fremen, would be ready to kill with no guilt at a moment's notice, and muses about how the same is not true for her. She darkly considers that this is for the good, as the Atreides have too much blood on their hands already. Emerging into the courtyard, Aaliyah leads the congregation of Naibs and guards into the council chamber room, where Stilgar is already waiting. Aaliyah sits in the large throne-like chair at the end of the room, while Korba is brought in. Stilgar asks where Paul is, and she replies that he has delegated this task to her as her reverend mother. The Naibs are not exactly pleased, but she whips out some Fremen law regarding the authority of reverend mothers, which shuts them up, although a few are clearly still unhappy about it. She notes the faces of those who look displeased for a later discussion, which doesn't really bode well for them. Before the trial proper even begins, Korba protests his innocence, although he is pretty roundly ignored. Stilgar reads out the charges. We don't hear everything, because Aaliyah is not entirely paying attention. But basically, Korba is accused of conspiring with enemies to kill Paul. Korba looks upset and keeps shaking his head throughout. Aaliyah broods throughout this, which is why we don't hear all of what Stilgar says, and interestingly, towards the end, thinks that all of this is just nonsense. Korba again proclaims his innocence and demands to meet his accuser, which is a smart play in a room full of Fremen Naibs, of which Korba himself was once counted a member. From Aaliyah's thoughts, we learn that Korba was never the smartest, but rose through the ranks because he was brave and reliable and deeply held the Fremen values. Aaliyah wonders whether the assembled Naibs fear seeing themselves in Korba's place, for good reason or not, although she feels that the Naibs are all dangerous regardless of their guilt or participation in the conspiracy. Korba again demands to confront his accusers. Aaliyah counters by suggesting that he may have accused himself, and Korba is taken aback, clearly fearing that she will claim to have evidence against him from her visions, which he would be hard-pressed to defend against. Like, what do you say to your quasi-goddess who has accused you based on her magic powers?
Yeah, I guess you just beg for them to let you go or give you a second chance. There's really nothing else you can do.
Yeah, you don't really have an equally powerful alibi.
Right.
Aaliyah continues speaking, describing various transgressions against the Empire here on Arrakis, before being interrupted by Paul himself, who strides in and announces that the conspirators have successfully captured a sandworm to take to another planet. He stands next to Aaliyah and Stilgar welcomes him while avoiding looking at his eyes, or lack thereof. Paul turns to face Korba, who has been conspicuously silent, and challenges him as to why he is not praising Paul as usual. Among the Naibs, there are whispers about how Paul should have been sent to the desert, and how he is broken from in law by not doing so. Paul turns to face him and demonstrates how well he can still see, describing the color of one's man's clothes and insulting him while he does it.
I thought this was such a cool moment, where Paul is just like, no, fuck you, I can see you, you're wearing this.
You and your fucking dirty clothes.
Yeah, you're still dirty.
Take a bath. Angrily, Paul turns back to Korba and proclaims that there is guilt on his face. Korba protests that he may have associated with the guilty, but he himself is not guilty, before falling silent. Aaliyah stands and strides over to Korba, basically getting all up in his face and intimidating him, as he desperately looks to the gallery of Naibs to avoid her gaze. Paul demands to know who he is looking at, and Korba protests that Paul cannot possibly see. Paul tells Korba that he can see him perfectly well without eyes, and begins describing every tiny motion Korba is making, as Korba becomes more and more panicked. Seems interesting that sycophant Korba wouldn't believe Paul's magic powers. Aaliyah studies the crowd, looking for faces that might be growing concerned that Korba might imminently break under pressure. She notes anyone who looks suspicious. Korba pulls himself together and again demands to know who has accused him. Aaliyah says it was Othium, and Korba protests that this can't be because Othium is dead. Paul wonders how Korba could have known that, surmising that it must be through Korba's spy system. Paul tells Korba he knows all about his spies and couriers, and implies that it was Korba himself who had the Stoneburner brought to Arrakis, or built here, or whatever. Korba protests that he obtained it for the defense of the Kizarat, but that it was stolen.
I feel like that whole thing about Korba saying, oh, it couldn't have been Othium because he's dead, and then Paul being like, I never told you he was dead, is just a little bit too cute. Like, it's like one of those typical things in, like, a murder mystery or something like that.
Oh, it happens all the time.
Yeah, where you're like, oh, I didn't stab, and it's like, oh, I never told you there was a knife. And it's just,
Yeah, a little bit too on the nose. It may have been a little bit fresher when this was written, but it's the kind of thing where it's just so ubiquitous in culture now that it, no matter when you read it at this point, it just seems overdone.
Yeah.
Korba then switches tactics, proclaiming how he has always worked for the love of Muad'Dib and asking how a dead man could accuse him. Paul and Aaliyah explain that Othium's voice lives on, alluding to the distrans message encoded in Bijaz, although they don't really explain this outright. But we can infer what they mean from context.
Yeah.
Paul points out that some of the Naives named by Othium are not here today, because they actually fled with the stolen sandworm. Paul tells Korba that even if he himself freed Korba right now, he'd still be a dead man for his role in all of this, pointedly referencing the many men who lost their eyes due to Korba's actions, as well as their families, who probably would hunt down and murder Korba if they had half a chance.
Right.
Korba tries to protest that it was just an accident and that the men are getting Tlilaxu eyes anyway. Paul questions what price might be paid for those eyes that isn't even suspected, and the gathered Naiads are not looking particularly kindly on Korba at this moment. Paul muses about what possible reason the Kizarat could have for obtaining a stone burner, wondering what use they would have for a device used either to blow up planets or blind enemy combatants, if they truly intended to only use it for some ill-defined defense. He questions whether they wished to blind anyone who tried to observe them. So this is a good question of if Korba is telling the truth here, which I don't know if we really come down one way or the other, but even if we take it at face value that he just got the stone burner for the defense of the Kizarat, like, why? What was he planning to do with it? Like, threaten to blow up Arrakis if anyone threatens the Kizarat? Like, that's not helpful.
Yeah, he's basically back into a corner at this point.
Yeah, it's definitely not a great explanation. Korba protests weakly that the stone burner was just a curiosity, and that they technically obeyed the law against anyone except the Landrad having atomics or something like that. I guess because they're not technically atomics, they're just similar to atomics, the Stoneburners.
Atomics adjacent.
Yeah. Paul seems to accuse Korba of driving the Kizarat to have acquired the weapon rather than any organic interest by the Kizarat at large. Like, he seems to paint this as a personal goal of Korba's that he kind of used the Kizarat for, rather than the Kizarat sitting down and saying, we need a Stoneburner.
Right.
Because again, that doesn't make a ton of sense. Korba demands to hear the voice of his accuser, basically wishing to hear the distrans of Othium's voice, even if Othium himself is dead. Stilgar jumps in here and agrees that he has the right to do this, which Aaliyah is surprised by. She watches while Stilgar pompously recites Fremen law, and wonders what has become of Stilgar, if this credulous bureaucrat is all that is left of the man. She feels as if he is hearing his words even before he says them. Stilgar concludes that whatever he has done, Korba is still a Fremen and must be tried under Fremen laws and customs. Aaliyah feels kind of frustrated that this trial is still going on. She notes that after Stilgar's intervention, Korba has relaxed a bit and maintains the air of an unjustly accused man. She even sees a self-satisfied smirk across his face, thinking that it seems as if he has received some kind of message that help is on the way. She feels as if they had previously had the moment to end all of this, but all of the momentum was lost when Stilgar intervened, and she looks at him suspiciously, wondering whether he could be in on the plot himself. However, then Paul thanks Stilgar, and Stilgar silently communicates to them that he will get the truth from Korba in a cell. So, clearly they've decided that it will be more effective to put on this kind of show for the Naibs, and then use alternative methods to get the truth out of Korba out of their sight.
Right.
Paul orders that Korba be taken to a maximum security location and be allowed no visitors except his counsel, which seems fair. But then he immediately appoints Stilgar as Korba's counsel, which obviously Korba greatly protests against, demanding to select his own counsel. It's like, oh, you're accused of conspiring against me. Let me appoint my, like, right-hand man as your lawyer. That's certainly not biased. However, in response, Paul accuses him of questioning Stilgar's fairness, and before he can say much more, Korba is taken away. The Naibs then begin to file out of the chamber, leaving Paul and Aaliyah to speak. Paul explains that he did not want to start any violent confrontations until they are sure that they will have full control of the situation, and thanks Stilgar for playing his part perfectly. Aaliyah seems annoyed at having been left in the dark, but it appears that it was just part of the plan to allow her to identify which of the Naibs were likely involved, although I don't know how telling her in advance would have really changed that, but whatever.
Yeah.
Apparently, if Paul had just killed Korba outright, nobody would really have batted an eye, but this performance was meant to unsettle and reveal the traitors. Paul tells Aaliyah to give the full list of suspicious Naibs to Stilgar. Aaliyah feels unsettled as she looks at Paul and thinks about how he sees things, feeling as if he has them all dancing on strings as they fit into his vision moment by moment, the reality of the future depending on his choices. So she's kind of feeling a bit the same thing as Paul, where, you know, she's obviously making her own choices, but they're all aligning with what Paul has already seen. So it again gets to that question or feeling like you don't have free will.
Right. You're all part of some plan that you just have to carry out.
Exactly. Paul delegates his morning audience with the people to Aaliyah after trying and clearly failing to reassure Stilgar that he has nothing to fear from Paul. Because I think Stilgar is pretty also unsettled by the whole visions thing. The doors to the outer chamber are opened, and a crush of people are pushing ahead, desperate to make their pleas to the Emperor, and Aaliyah heads out to give Paul and Chaney a chance to slip out the back. She tells the clerk that she will be speaking for Paul today, and the clerk turns to organize the people. Stilgar tells Aaliyah that he can recall when she would have immediately understood what Paul was up to back in the council chamber, so kind of pointing out that it was unusual that she didn't just pick it up herself, like she, you know, was clearly smart enough to do. She protests that she was distracted and that furthermore, Stilgar has been different lately. Specifically, she says there has been a dramatic change in him, which seems a deep personal affront to Stilgar, who is definitely not a man who wants to be associated with drama in any way.
Yeah.
Distressed, he asks her whether she trusts him. She tells him that of course she does. She and Paul have always trusted him. But she ominously reveals that she knows he is also preparing to betray Paul, and that she only hopes it does not destroy the both of them. Then she turns away before he can respond, which is quite cold. As she turns away, she takes in the expression on his face, and feels that it reflects the paradox of her mother's letter. When religion becomes the government, morality is replaced by the law. And thus we end the chapter. So I'm really interested to see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what form Stilgar's betrayal is going to take. It's the kind of thing where it makes me wonder if it would be turned on its head, sort of, like, you know, betraying someone sounds like an explicitly bad thing, but it could be that, I don't know, Paul orders Stilgar to kill him and Stilgar refuses.
Do you think it's a lot of inner conflict with him, just kind of dealing with the fact that Paul's blind now and his beliefs lead him to a place where he feels strongly that Paul should walk out into the desert because he's blind now, because that's what the Fremen belief is, but at the same time, like, Paul is the Emperor, so that's problematic, right?
Yeah, I feel like Stilgar is on board with the, like, Paul can still see, so it's fine. But I do think that he was already kind of questioning the events that have happened under Paul and his own role in them.
Mm-hmm.
And the extent of the death in the galaxy and his own contributions to organizing that. And maybe just reconsidering things that he hadn't really considered before because he was just adhering to his following of his messiah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is maybe just building to that, and perhaps he will, like, refuse to follow an order or disagree with Paul. Like, I can't really picture Stilgar, like, stabbing Paul in the back, like, literally betraying him in such a obvious way, but I kind of wonder how that will play out.
Right.
I feel like it might be a more, like, refuses to follow an order because he disagrees with it kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that would track.
But yeah, definitely interested to see what that means, though, because it's a very ominous statement. She just, like, says it to him and is like, we will not discuss this further. I'm busy. It's like, yeah, that's a rough way to leave a conversation.
So what other takeaways do you have from this chapter?
I do wonder what Korba's role in all of this was and what he hoped to gain. Like, what is the benefit of hurting Paul?
Well, I guess if Paul is the leader, right, he's like this messiah. If he dies, he becomes a martyr, and the people in government who have the most power are the Kizarat at that point, right? So they'd be able to basically seize full control of the government.
I mean, you still have Aaliyah.
Yeah, you do, but maybe they feel like they have enough political strength that they would sort of, like, balance out with her a little bit better than Paul, or maybe there'd be a second plot to deal with Aaliyah.
So it seems like maybe Korba and co. wanted to kill Paul, but the conspiracy was kind of co-opting their plans to instead kill Chaney to undermine Paul.
Okay.
Because, I mean, it seemed like there were different goals, right? I mean, yeah. Even going back to, what's his name, Bronzo's history, what you said seems accurate, that Korba wanted to martyr Paul and blame Chaney, whereas it seems like the conspirators had the or at least the Tlatlaxu had the opposite goal of killing Chaney, and by doing so, forcing Paul to bargain with in some way. So it seems interesting that maybe the conspirators kind of use the Fremen conspirators.
Yeah, but at the same time, maybe both of those things could be true and align their goals, right? If the Tlatlaxu eliminate... Well, no, I guess if you're trying to completely discredit Paul, that wouldn't line up. Yeah, you're right. But I think if Paul is out of the picture, or at least lessened, and maybe you can sort of have some propaganda work against Paul if he's blind and, you know, maybe the Kizarat doesn't have to put this out specifically, but if the people know that Paul is blind, they're probably going to have some doubts about him, right? And that sort of elevates the position of the Kizarat because they're a little bit more pure than Paul is at that point.
But does it? Because they're built on his religion, so if he's discredited, that's not good for the Kizarat, which is, I think, why they want to martyr him. I don't know what it would benefit them to discredit Chaney, or, like, blame Chaney, unless they just needed a patsy. And she's a convenient one? I don't know, but yeah. It's just interesting that it just seems like there were maybe crossed purposes there, of different goals of who to target.
Yeah, but I definitely wouldn't put it past the Bene Gesserit and the Tlatlaxu to use the Kizarat to their advantage.
Oh,
just
absolutely.
Loop them in on this and tell them, oh yeah, we'll get rid of Paul for you, and that isn't really the plan.
Yeah, and the thing is, I don't even know that the Kizarat at large is involved versus just Korba, who is a former Naib and happens to be the head of the Kizarat, so it would benefit him in the sense that a lot of the Fremen are unhappy with the way Paul has been doing things, and him as the head of the Kizarat, so he may be jumped in with the Fremen conspirators rather than him being really representative of the Kizarat at large, which is composed of, you know, many true believers and some people who just don't really give a fuck.
Yeah, but it makes me think that the greater conspiracy was sort of playing 4D chess with the Kizarat, right? Like we were just talking
about. And the Fremen Knights.
Yeah, and the Fremen Knights, just using them as part of their plot.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, none of these groups are above using people.
Right.
That's, like, kind of their whole thing.
Yeah, and it sort of kills two birds with one stone, too, if they, to an extent, discredit the Kizarat and weaken that a bit.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I'm sure they would not consider it a negative at all to have Korba, like, take the fall for this and have the head of the Kizarat face a public downfall. All right, so you have a couple of prediction-y follow-up questions to ask me, right?
Yes, I do. So I first have a character fate prediction, because we were introduced to Bajaz last time, but we didn't really get into him. So what do you think is going to happen with him?
That's a great question. I mean, at this point, we don't really know if he plays much of a further role. I mean, he's the Distrans, so they've gotten that information from him. So, like, what is his role now? What does it mean that he's a catalyst? Is it simply the information that he carries, which is meant to be a catalyst for revealing the fault lines in Paul's support among the Fremen by revealing the traitors, and then Paul will take revenge on the traitors, and maybe even some of the loyal knaves won't like that. Or is there something else that he's supposed to do? Like, does the catalyst refer to something else? Or is he just, like, is his role done now? You mm-hmm. don't really know. I have a sense that it's not just done now because we spent so much time dealing with his conversations with Paul previously. So I assume he has some more important role than just being a message. I mean, you could have literally put the message in anything else than a new character. As for what his ultimate fate will be, God, I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. I don't know. I'm pretty 50-50. I'll guess he survives, but I don't really have anything to support that.
Okay.
I feel like, because we don't really know what his role in the plot going forward is, that I don't really have a good sense of what danger he's in.
So you think that he'll live, but you also think that he's going to have, like, more of a purpose than what he's had so far?
Yes, because I'm not convinced that him conveying this particular bit of information about the traitor Naives is enough of a role to justify all the time we spend with his weird speech patterns and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the comments that Paul had about how he was important or well-made Sylaxu creation that maybe Othium was tricked into taking was kind of the implication. Because he made a comment about Othium is like, oh yeah, he was like some toy they discarded and I found him on some planet, and Paul's like, the Sylaxu definitely didn't discard this guy. So it makes you wonder.
Makes you think there's got to be more to it.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Like, I don't really have a good sense of what, but it might be that this catalyst refers to something other than just triggering a split in the Fremen.
Two other questions here. Do you think Paul will be able to discredit himself?
And you're asking that because it sounds like in the future to avert the darkest timeline.
Yes.
He will have to do that. I mean, just based on the fact that he has seen that that is an existing timeline that could happen, it seems certainly possible.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what would do it. I mean, it seems like he has seen that if this is an existing possible future, it's just distasteful and will probably lead to an unfortunate outcome for Chaney, if not himself. I mean, he's already lost his eyes. I wonder if now that he has these new powers, they might make him seem more godlike, but it also seems like it really unsettles people, so maybe people will start to distrust him. There are already whispers among the Naibs of he should go into the desert, and people are really freaked out by the fact that this blind man can still see. So I wonder if that will just start to kind of sow doubt. But I wonder what could fully discredit Paul, unless he just, like, comes forward and says, like, the jihad was a mistake, we shouldn't have done it. Like, he could explicitly do that. I wonder what the reaction to that would be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. But I certainly think it's possible. And it seems like he thinks that that's the route he has to take.
Right.
In order to avert, like, the worst future.
Okay.
I mean, I guess I would say that yes, he will, because it seems like it's like the least bad future of several potentially bad futures. Like, it will lead to Chaney's death, or like that future includes Chaney's death, clearly includes his blindness, and it will suck, but it will ultimately end the jihad or something.
Okay.
So I guess, yes, I think he will try, because that seems like it's the path he's selected, but I guess he could change his mind, and or if his visions aren't fully accurate, that might not be how it plays out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, final prediction. Will hate be able to awaken his Duncan memories?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I guess it's possible, but it doesn't sound like anyone knows if it can even be done at all. And you'd think if it was possible that Sylaxu would have figured out how to do it. I would think that he'll get some memory flashes and maybe get some stuff back and become more like Duncan. But I don't know if he will just, like, fully get all of his memories back.
Okay.
It's just...
So you're predicting that that won't happen?
Yeah, like, I'm not gonna say, like, I'm confident that it won't happen. It just... It doesn't seem like there's any evidence that anyone's even come close to that. It just doesn't seem like anyone knows that that's even something that's possible for a Gola, and you would think that the Sylaxu would have potentially figured that out, like, figured out how to do it. mm-hmm. already, and there's just no indication that they have. So, I mean, I guess it's possible that Haight slash Duncan will be the first, but I guess there's just no evidence that it is possible, so I'm going to lean towards no.
Okay.
But I wouldn't be, like, very surprised if it did happen, I guess, because it's... I guess it would be kind of a heroic narrative if he does recover his memories, despite all expectations, but I lean towards no, just because of the lack of evidence that it's a thing that can happen.
Fair enough.
So does that wrap up our episode?
I believe it does.
Now we only have, what, 5 chapters left?
5 chapters left. 2 episodes. Exciting
so
times.
So much shorter than Toon.
I know.
I keep saying that, but it's just, I don't know, just shocking that we're almost at the end already.
Yep. And Children's a little bit longer than this one, but again, a lot shorter than Dune.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do any of them approach the length of Dune?
I think God Emperor is a little long, but it's not as long as the first book. The first book is definitely the longest of all of them.
Okay. All right, cool.
So, till next time, I'm Alex.
I'm Elaine.
Thanks for listening. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Pod Emperor of Dune. If you enjoyed listening to us, we'd appreciate a review on your podcasting host of choice, and be sure to let your friends know about us. You can find us on Twitter under the handle NerdIsayMore, or send us an email at nerdisaymore@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us further, please go to patreon.com/nerdisaymore, where you can also get access to exclusive content.